Rampolo v. Commonwealth, Vernita R. Cheney, Appellants Counsel, Craig W. Stallard, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Appellees Counsel.
All right, Justice Chafin is not sitting on this case. However, Senior Justice Kuntz is. Ms. Cheney, you may begin.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court. Good morning. Vernita Cheney on behalf of the appellant, Paulo. I ask to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
How many minutes?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
All right, that's fine.
The felony convictions and the decisions of the Court of Appeals should be reversed for three reasons. First, the trial court misconstrued the statutory interpretation of Virginia Code 18.2-107, destruction of a public record. Second, the destruction requires fraudulent specific intent. And third, the public records were not destroyed under the plain meaning of the statute. The facts in these cases are not in dispute. While inside the clerk's office, Ms. Rampolo wrote in the margins of the documents in the court file from her divorce proceeding in sight of the clerk. The court has never addressed the elements of Virginia Code 18.2-107, and therefore it is incumbent upon this court to correct the erroneous statutory interpretation of the penal statute. First, the trial court in the Court of Appeals erred in finding that 18.2, the fraudulent intent part, did not apply to the actions of destroy, and there was no specific intent requirement.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you a question about that?
Yes.
What does it really mean? I'm struggling to understand linguistically what it means to fraudulently destroy. I understand fraudulently secreting, but how does one fraudulently destroy something? And would it be okay to destroy it if you're not doing it secretly? You just go, I'm coming in, I'm going to destroy your public document, here it is, I destroy it right in your face, no fraud at all, I'm owning up to it. Would that be non-criminal?
Thank you for your question. I think if there wasn't a fraudulent intent, as we argue in this case, then it would be non-criminal under this particular statute. And this is why we're arguing that Ms. Rampolo was erroneously convicted under that interpretation. The fraudulently is important because if you look at the statute, we have three forms of conduct. We have steal, we have secrete, and we have destroy. Steal inherently denotes something that's nefarious. It inherently unlawful criminal behavior, right? But when you look at the words secrete and you look at the words destroy, they're innocuous. They can have a meaning that is not criminal in context, and they can have a meaning that is criminal in context. And that's why it's important that the word fraudulent, the adverb before the verb, modifies that is argument to the trial court.
If someone intentionally destroys a public document with the intent to destroy it, but does not do it with any misleading statements, does not do it undercover, does not do it in secretion of, in secret, There's no misrepresentation at all. They just come in and say, I'm going to destroy this document because I don't want it, and does it. Why would that not be covered by the statute?
Unless the evidence and the facts of the case point to fraudulent as the statute is written, then our argument is that it would not be covered under this particular statute. The penal code has other statutes that possibly could apply. Maybe destruction of property that doesn't use the word fraudulently and that focus on just the intent to actually do the destruction. But for this particular statute under 18.2-107, the General Assembly clearly spoke when they wrote the words fraudulent before secrete and destroy.
Okay, one last question on this for me. What does it mean to fraudulently destroy? I mean, give me an example of fraudulently destroying something as opposed to not fraudulently destroying it.
An example would be if there was ill intent behind the destruction. Fraudulently can mean ill will, it can mean evil intent, and if that was done in that way, it can. Fraudulently can also mean by doing it by fraud, a fraudulent act. So for example, taking something by lie or deceit and then having it destroyed could be that. And obviously those were not the facts of this case, so we didn't argue those points, but that would be an example for this court as to what is fraudulent.
Counsel, I'll just, I'll just put my cards on the table. I found more persuasive the argument that destroy means physical destructions like burning, shredding, that kind of thing, as opposed to rendering inoperative. And then you have the rule of lenity in your corner that says if it's ambiguous, then it cuts in favor of the defendant's liberty. Then the question becomes, well, was that preserved? And if not, can we reach it under ends of justice? I know that's a mouthful, but it would help me if you could address some of those points.
Yes, thank you, Justice McCollum. Of course, we agree with your analysis of it, and we do believe that destroy fits into to the example that you just gave. The issue was preserved in the trial court, and it was also preserved in the Court of Appeals in our assignments of error 1 and 2. In the trial court, we discussed and reviewed argued what destroy was in motion in limine, and that is in a joint appendix starting at page 86. We had a lengthy discussion about that, and at one point, the government tried to expand the definition of destroy, which counsel vehemently objected to, and that's on joint appendix 92. In addition to that, in the motion to strike, starting, I believe, on joint appendix 440, counsel presented argument to the court as to the statutory construction of destroy. Also, the statutory construction of fraudulent and how the destruction must be fraudulent. These are legal issues that were presented before this court, and this court has held that it may review questions of law de novo when the legal issues were before the court, even without making a formal exception. And we are asking the court to find that those issues with statutory interpretation were preserved in the trial court, preserved in the Court of Appeals, and we're asking the court to rule on that de novo standard of review.
Right, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the argument that was made on the other side is there was a motion to strike made that was not renewed, and therefore, under some of our cases, that's a waiver. So that's where that question was coming from.
Exactly. The court in the Commonwealth are relying on Murillo versus Commonwealth. And we believe that is misplaced and wrong for these facts in this situation. First, the facts in this case are undisputed. The only question is really a legal question that has de novo review upon appellate courts. In the Murillo-Rodriguez case, that dealt with the guilt of a sexual assault that turned on the defense of the evidence. The defendant recanted the statements to the police and contested that the sexual encounter was consensual. And then the Commonwealth had extensive rebuttal evidence. It was not a legal question of law, but it was more of a factual question and a credibility issue. So therefore, Murillo-Rodriguez doesn't apply in this particular case with Ms. Rampallo, making legal arguments to the court extensively in the motion in limine and the motion to strike, and additionally in the jury instructions. The court had ample opportunity to rule on those issues, heard those issues, and therefore the issue is preserved. But we are requesting this
counsel,
court.
Counsel, yeah. In Murillo-Rodriguez, wasn't there intertwined in the question a legal issue as to the meaning of abduction? It seemed more similar to your case in that there was a question as to whether legally there was an abduction.
I think your Honor is correct in that. However, there were some other issues that were pertinent in that case that are not in this case. And really, it mainly deals with the credibility of facts and the factual issues that are not at issue in this particular case with Ms. Rampallo. And so this is purely an issue of law with respect to the statutory interpretation of the pertinent elements need to criminalize under 18.2107. Did that answer your question?
You did, thank you. I have one follow-up question. If I accept your argument that you preserved the legal question in the motion to strike by raising it, did you waive it again when you offered a jury instruction that contained your proffered definition, but you asked the court not to give the jury instruction?
No, because the issues had already been preserved with our arguments in the motion in limine and our arguments in motion to strike. The the additional arguments with the jury instructions was trying to put forth an argument that the court again rejected. Well, it was withdrawn, but the issue had already been preserved. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
If there's no more questions, I would like to proceed and go back to the point of fraudulent intent, just very, very, very briefly. This court in Washington has rejected the argument of the disjunctive or separates the meaning of the clauses, and that's essentially what the Court of Appeals relied on in rejecting the fact that there was that fraudulent intent was a requirement, a specific intent requirement for this particular statute. There is no modifier before Steele because it's unnecessary to have a modifier before Steele. Again, that denotes nefarious and inherently unlawful conduct. But you need a modifier before the words secrete and the words destroy. Secrete and destroy, or destroy, excuse me, is the series. And placing the modifier, which is fraudulent, before that series denotes that fraudulent modifies both secrete and destroy. The correct reading is that the General Assembly intended for the modifier fraudulent to apply to only the words after steal, which was secrete and destroy. So therefore, we would disagree with the court's analysis, the Court of Appeals analysis, with respect to Long. Let me explain this also. The interpretation of destroy in 18.2107 without fraudulent intent would feloniously criminalize negligent but innocent purposeful behavior. It is apparent that the legislation had no intention of punishing someone who accidentally but intentionally placed a public record in the wrong file, mistaking it to be another. It would be absurd to read 18.2107 to infer that the legislators would intend to punish someone who accidentally but intentionally destroyed a public record.
This is Justice Kelsey again, but doesn't our precedent and the common law generally impute a general intent requirement in every penal statute, even in the absence of a specific intent? And here the general intent would be intentional destruction as opposed to accidental destruction.
The court is correct. However, when there is specific language denoting intent, which we would argue fraudulently in this case, no one is denying that fraudulently is not the intent for secrete. The issue in this case is, does fraudulently also apply to destroy?
And so what you've been saying is that if you don't have that modifier for destroy, you got strict liability. And all I'm suggesting is that right? Doesn't the general intent imputation prevent that worst case scenario?
I think the court is correct with that, that you don't necessarily have to have a strict liability and you can infer a general intent. However, that is not specifically the issue at hand. The issue at hand is that there is a specific intent. The Commonwealth has conceded that with respect to secrete. The issue is whether or not that specific intent also modifies destroy. And that goes back to my earlier argument that it does, and that reading the plain language of the statute and giving it its common sense meaning, in addition to applying the canons, that it does make sense that it applies to that as well. I would also point to the court, just as this court did in Washington, looking at 18.2107 in light of the companion statute, 18.2472, which deals with destruction of public record when you are a public official. In 18.2472, it lists additional verbs, entry, erase, alter, which are not included in 18.2107. It also does not list the word steal. It doesn't have steal in it at all. But again, the placement of fraudulently prior to that conduct, all of that conduct, is modified each and every one of those actions. And so because 18.2107 has less actions basically just secrete and destroy, it follows, but it follows the same logic in 18.2472 that all of the actions after the modifier fraudulently apply, and therefore that is the intent in this case. I see I'm at my time, so I would reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Well, let me explain how this works. You have 1 second left for rebuttal on that clock. You ask for the time. The justices ask questions. They eat into your time. you obviously didn't understand. How about a compromise? You'll have 1 minute for rebuttal.
I can hear, Chief Justice.
All right.
All right. Chief Justice, this is Justice Goodwin. I have a question I'd like to ask counsel, if I might.
All right. Well, I just giveth and you taketh away. Go ahead.
Yeah. I have a question for you. When do you claim that the circuit court ruled on the issue of the definition of destroy? At what point in the proceeding did the court rule on that? And does it matter if it didn't do so when it instructed the jury?
To your last question, does it matter when it didn't do so when it instructed a jury? I think that the answer is it weighs in our favor that the court did not instruct the jury. But even if the court did instruct a jury, I think you still come with the same result. Again, looking at the motion in limine, the motion to strike and in the motion in limine in the joint appendix, the court rejected the argument and denied the motion to strike. And again, I would point to JA 441 and 445 with respect to the argument of statutory construction for destroy, and then JA starting at 86 going to 96 with respect to motion in limine.
All right. Thank you, counsel. That's fine. Thank you very much.
All right, counsel. Your time has expired. There's no rebuttal left. All right, Mr. Stollard.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This is Craig Stollard on behalf of the Commonwealth. To begin with the argument first raised by Ms. Rompolo, the statutory interpretation, I believe it appears Ms. Rompolo is putting the cart before the horse. I think the first step is to look at the plain language of the statute and determine whether or not it's ambiguous. Here, the plain language of the statute is pretty clear. It is to steal, secrete, fraudulently secrete, or destroy the documents. And as the court has noted, fraudulently modifying secrete makes sense. That's not ambiguous. And it also does not make sense for the fraudulently to apply to the word destroy in this context. As such, the statute on its face is not ambiguous, so we do not need to engage in any type of statutory construction, which would lead to a strained result. It doesn't make sense to have fraudulently apply to both secrete and destroy. So therefore, I think the trial court and the Court of Appeals did not err in making that determination.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you this? It may be an academic question, but if I were to say I destroyed something, I wouldn't ordinarily, and I don't think the average person would ordinarily think that that meant I simply defaced it. If I deface something, that's bad, shouldn't happen, but destroying it is a order of magnitude higher than in common speech. So again, it may be an academic question, but do you see that as a problem in your interpretation of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, I do understand your question, your concern. However, given the context we're dealing with here, I don't think that is a problem. And mainly because we're dealing with destruction of public documents. And I think the context that the legislature was trying to address was destroying a document, therefore it's no longer usable as a public document. While here defacing it may not constitute destruction in another context, here the clerk testified that because of the defacing, the clerk was unable to certify it as a public document, because it is no longer the original document that was prepared by the court.
The problem is it loses its originality the moment anybody other than the judge or the clerk writes something on it. So if she'd have just put a smiley face in the corner, and no one would even notice it, but it's there, it would technically not be the original document, and that would be still called a destroyed document?
Well, Your Honor, it may be a matter of degree. Here we have obviously a little bit more than just a smiley face in the corner. We have written all over the margins of three separate documents, covering most of the margins in this order. So I think that the fact finder did not err in determining that based on the testimony from the clerk and being able to observe these documents, that they were in fact destroyed to the extent that could no longer be used as they had previously been used as a court document, as a public record. Also, the argument regarding destruction, I believe, was waived by Ms. Rompolo. There was a motion to strike. They proceeded to put on evidence. They failed to renew the motion to strike. That would waive the argument made during the initial motion to strike.
Counsel. The motion to strike goes to the sufficiency of the evidence. This motion to strike, if you will, perhaps had two aspects to it. One was, what is the definition of destroy? The other is, based on the definition of destroy, is the evidence that has been put on sufficient to survive a motion to strike? If I read the trial transcript, that during the motion to strike, the court accepted the Commonwealth's motion of the Commonwealth's version of what the definition of destroy is. That's a legal statutory construction of what does destruction mean. Why would that need to be re-raised in order to be preserved? The notion is the court has been advised of what the defendant thinks destroy is. The court has said that is not the definition of destroy. Why does it have to be re-raised in a motion to strike at the end of her case, of the Commonwealth's case?
Well, Your Honor, my reading of the motion to strike was, like, as I think the court indicated, in the context of the evidence being insufficient. There was an argument regarding how the definition of destroy and how the Commonwealth failed to meet its burden under that definition. Because it was made in the context of a sufficiency claim, I think the case law is clear that it would still need to be renewed at the conclusion of all the evidence. And as that was not done, even though it was necessarily going to a statutory or legal definition of a word, it still needed to be renewed because it was made in the context of sufficiency, which does need to be renewed at the close of all evidence.
Do we have a case that specifically makes that distinction, that even if there is a legal issue overlaid by the factual issue, that you have to re-raise it if your only point is this is not the definition?
Your Honor, I don't know if I can quote a case other than the Murillo Rodriguez case, which I cited for other reasons as well. But it seems that if all you're trying to do is make a legal definition argument, that's a jury instruction issue as opposed to a motion to strike issue. And as the court noted, she presented those jury instructions and asked that they not be given. So again, in that context, I think the issue has been waived. And again, even if the court were to find it's not waived, I understand, again, the court's concerns. However, the testimony that was presented and the evidence that the jury was able to hear and related to this, I think the conclusion they came to is not plainly wrong or without evidence to support it, as these documents as public records were destroyed in the sense they are no longer public records. And that, I think, is what the General Assembly's intent was to criminalize, was to making public records unusable or useless or have no value as a public record.
So you would understand then that had she offered the instruction and asked that it be given defining the elements prior to the jury deciding the case, that she would have properly preserved her error on the legal question because they're dealing with the elements of the crime for the jury at that point.
I believe that would be correct, Your Honor. Obviously, if the judge had rejected it, that would be an issue then on appeal regarding whether the court erred in failing to grant the instruction. That's, however, not the scenario we're dealing with in this case. And again, her argument regarding the motion in limine and so forth only dealt with evidence regarding destruction, not really with the definition of destruction. So the only two places it was possibly raised was the motion to strike, which is insufficient for at least two reasons, and two, the jury instructions, which were withdrawn at the last minute, and that not asked to be given. So I believe that we'll waive that issue there as well. I believe Justice McCullough had a question whether or not there's any other way to reach to it. And I don't believe the ends of justice apply in this case as well. From my understanding is that the first time she's asked for those to be invoked is in the reply brief, which I believe is too late. And in any event, in order to invoke the ends of justice, I have to establish a miscarriage of justice. And I don't believe the facts in this case rise to the level of a miscarriage of justice. So I don't believe this court could appropriately invoke the ends of justice to reach the issue.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again, were there any objections to the jury instructions that were given?
Your Honor, honestly, I don't recall.
On the issue of destroy?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because I don't believe the jury was actually instructed on the definition of destroy. So I don't know.
It goes to the jury with the standard jury instructions with simply the word destroy, and there was no objection to that, and there was no request for a definition. So why isn't that law the case anyway? In theory, she could have raised it and the court directly rule on it in a pretrial motion, but the jury decides the case on the instructions, and the instructions were unobjected to.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that is a clear basis for this court to affirm as well. Motion to strike is not the best place to raise that type of legal argument. I don't believe it was sufficient for a couple of reasons. And as the court's noted, the instructions went to the jury without objection. And based on those instructions, the jury was able to reach a verdict which was not, which had the evidence that supported it. And I think it should be
Mr. Stollard, may I ask a question about law of the case and the jury instructions? This was a kind of quirky case, if I recall the facts correctly, and I may not. But at the end of the case, when jury instructions are being proffered, the Commonwealth submits a jury instruction on destruction. The defendant submits a jury instruction on destruction, but asks that it not be given. The court accedes to the defendant's wishes, but holds the Commonwealth's jury instruction in abeyance, saying, if the jury asks for a definition, then I'm going to give the Commonwealth's instruction. Does that lead us to law of the case? I can't recall if there was an objection to the court saying, I'm going to give the Commonwealth's instruction if it's requested. It's never requested. It's never given.
Your Honor, I don't recall. I don't believe there was an objection to that. And again, as the court noted, there was no need to give that instruction as the jury had no questions with respect to that. So I do not believe there was an objection to that. If the record says differently, I stand corrected, but my recollection is there was no objection. I'd be happy to entertain any other questions the court may have. Otherwise, it asks this court to affirm the Court of Appeals.
All right. Thank you very much.